Welcome to Spoiler Alert. This is Steve Haskin.
And this is Andre Shane, and we're driving the streets of Chicago on a beautiful
fall
day.
Coming back from a gig.
As usual, today's subject on Spoiler Alert is the work of director David Fincher.
Yes, with a special emphasis on The Social Network,
which
will probably hit maybe towards the end of the podcast. So if you haven't seen it, you can still enjoy our musings on Mr. Fincher up to that point.
Yes, and
skip at the end.
There's not much to give away with The Social Network.
Well, I suppose that's true.
Steve, apparently, you know, if you don't know how The Social Network ends, he invents Facebook. So there you go. We just spoiled it for you. Sorry about that. But Fincher is an interesting filmmaker. You know, Fincher came out of music videos. I mean, that's sort of, he gained a lot of prominence doing music videos.
Yeah, he did some big ones in the late 80s, early 90s.
We've all seen his music videos. Even if you were not aware that they were directed by David Fincher, let's name a few. Of course, Madonna's Vogue.
Express Yourself by Madonna.
Both fantastic Madonna videos, amongst her best.
Cradle of Love by Billy Idol.
Maybe that's not one of his best.
That's a video I'm saying that a lot of people
have seen the Cradle of Love. What else? Jamie's Got a Gun by Aerosmith. That's a fine video, very stylish looking, and like if you see it, you can almost tell it's David Fincher. My personal favorite of his music video work would be Iggy Pop's Home, a video that was extremely influential visually. If you look it up on YouTube, check it out. I mean, after that song came out, after that video came out, like in 92, every other music video looked exactly like that, you know. So Home was very influential. So he was an influential music video director, to say the least. Definitely had his own vibe, his look. Loved black and white, a lot of very high contrast, beautiful black and white photography, and really a huge emphasis on editing as well. And that aspect has followed him into his film work.
All these videos we just described here were made when he was pretty damn young.
Absolutely.
Like in his early to mid-20s. David Fincher did not... Not only did he not go to film school, I don't think he even went to college. He always loved making movies. He got a job assisting at a smaller film production house when he was still a teenager, and actually got a job working at a Lucasfilm when he was just 18.
Was it Lucasfilm or Industrial Light?
Well, Industrial Light and Magic. Okay. But he worked on some of the special effects for Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I mean, he wasn't the lead, like, effects guy, but
he was in,
we're
in
talking
the credits.
A kid who's, you know, like 20, 21, working on those movies. And, you know, through his knowledge there, he got to do some music videos and quickly parlayed that skill and eventually got a job directing Alien 3.
That's right. Alien 3 was his first film. And you know, it's interesting. Alien 3 is a film not really fondly remembered by a lot of people, but I have to say that, I mean, in retrospect, Alien 3 was not a bad film. Kind of an interesting
take. No, it's got a cool vibe to it. I like Charles S. Dutton in the
Dutton
movie.
Dutton is fantastic in
the
film.
The relationship between him and Sigourney Weaver was an interesting take on it. The grizzled prison and the alien ravaged heroine.
What Fincher did with Alien 3 was he made a prison movie. So it was kind of, he kind of followed the concept that James Cameron set up of like setting these aliens in essentially a completely different genre. And it was interesting. It wasn't as effective, obviously, as Aliens. It wasn't as good as that. But it was a pretty solid picture, and there's some good action, some good effects, some good scares in the film. The film looks good. And it's, you know, it's a fairly respectable freshman feature film effort.
Very much so,
Fincher.
Yeah, I mean,
and it also put Fincher into this sort of big studio echelon. And this is sort of an aspect of David Fincher that's very specific to him in a sense, because he's a major studio director. David Fincher is not the guy who made his career on directing small movies. Right out of the gate, he gets a huge franchise picture does all right with it. And really, his career since then has been nothing but big studio pictures, one after another. Big stars, fairly big budgets, continuing to now when he can pretty much have a pick of whatever he wants to do.
Under no definition of the term is he an independent filmmaker.
Fincher's next film after Alien 3 is, of course,
Seven.
And Seven was a huge hit. And
despite its god-awful title. I hate the title. Not the title Seven. I hate that it's spelled with a seven in place of the V.
Yeah, instead of a V, you don't like the
I'm saying 15 years later, that's still wanky. So,
you know, that never really
bothered
me.
But it overcame that hump for me.
That's never bothered me, I gotta tell you. Seven is one of those films. I remember when I saw Seven. And Seven came out in the mid-90s, and, you know, there was a slew of serial killer movies at that time. I mean,
it also kind of combined the serial killer movie with the twist ending movie.
Well, that is
true, you know, like
as well.
It came out right around the time of The Usual Suspects. And I knew a lot of people in film school who considered, like, Seven the nastier brother of The Usual Suspects.
And I know it's hard for me to think of it as a twist, because there's not really much of a twist. It's a surprise. It's definitely shocking. It's not one of those twist endings like The Sixth Sense or anything like that.
No, but...
But, I mean, it's definitely twisty, and it is a surprise. At the end of the film, to spoil it for everybody who has not seen Seven by now, which... If you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you guys have seen Seven, but essentially the serial killer played by Kevin Spacey ends up killing Brad Pitt's wife and setting up Brad Pitt to commit the final murder in the series of the Seven Deadly Sins murder. And that final murder is of Kevin Spacey himself.
Yeah.
It's a very clever ending, and it's one of those few clever endings that's not too clever where it undermines the movie. And that's a common thing with movies with quote-unquote clever twists at the end, where it's just become too clever.
The ending of that movie is also kind of... I would say it's more of a Polanski-type ending, where, you know, the film is set up where the villain has hatched a plot to morally compromise one of the heroes.
Right.
And in your traditional Hollywood... you know, in quotes, Hollywood ending, the hero finds a way around it to defeat the villain without being morally compromised.
Right.
In Seven, the hero is in fact morally compromised.
Exactly.
All his morals and society do in fact come shattered through one act of violence. So in a way, the villain gets exactly what he wanted.
Exactly. He wins.
The ending of Seven, it's a bleak ending, not just because... you know, Brad Pitt's wife is dead, but because, you know, you walk out of that thing like, wow, maybe the villain had a point. He actually achieved what he wanted to. This element of shady morals, it constantly reoccurring through Fincher's work.
Yes.
That one of the great things about Fincher is he makes these huge Hollywood entertainments that are often genre films, but within them... there are serious moral questions that are being pondered and not necessarily answered.
Particularly with Seven. Seven is a fairly intelligent film. It's certainly not for everybody. It's very dark. It's hardcore. It's graphic. And it's very bleak and depressing. But there is an underlying, you know, philosophy in it, the philosophy that I may not agree with, but nonetheless, it's there, and you cannot take it for granted. It is not accidental. It is not sort of haphazard. It is not particularly easy to swallow, but it's there in a big way. So when it's there, his films tend to be very good or even great. And when it's not there, well, then you get The Game.
Andre, what's your take on The Game? I haven't seen The Game in many years.
You know, I actually watched The Game fairly recently. And, you know, The Game is it's a film starring Michael Douglas and Sean Penn. And, well, that's a pretty darn good cast, you say, right, Steve? And the concept of the film is Michael Douglas plays this jaded fat cat, this ultra-rich executive guy, who, as for his 50th birthday, gets handed a birthday present by his ne'er-do-well brother, played by Sean Penn, And a birthday present involves this bizarre game. And essentially the game, it's one of those games where the world is playing a game on Michael Douglas, and Michael Douglas just does not seem to realize that he's being played in some kind of giant, incredibly complex, convoluted, ultra-sophisticated plot whose whole purpose is to make Michael Douglas understand that he's just not living his life to the fullest, Steve. He's just not, you know, he's not enjoying every moment as though it were his last. If that sounds like a crock of shit to you, well, that pretty much describes my feeling about the game. If you really think about the film, if you think about its plot machinations, if you think about it, you try to think of it in terms of realism, it's total nonsense. I mean, the movie is just silly. Having said that, the movie is also quite watchable. It's fairly entertaining. Douglas is very good in it. Sean Penn is good in it, and there's lots of good supporting work in the film as well. It's, you know, it's kind of a fun film, but it's not a good film.
At the time, it felt a bit like a parlor trick to me, that, you know, like, okay, I've got this clever script, and let's see if we can pull it off, and I guess he pulls it off, but as you just mentioned in your synopsis, it's like, is the idea you're trying to pull off all that interesting anyway? One of the things I think maybe failed Fincher on that particular film is by this point, just three films in, there's already very much kind of a Fincher aesthetic. You know, that his films tend to be kind of dark. And I mean, visually.
Dark, right.
Visually, I don't mean in subject matter, though that's also true. But just visually, you know, he uses, all three of these films have different cinematographers, but there's still kind of an overarching, you can tell Fincher has, like, all right, I want rich blacks, not a lot of bright colors. There's some golden hues that peek in, but it's dark. Fincher also, you know, he's not a director without humor. There's some very funny moments in Fincher films.
Sure.
But what he is not is light. I mean, everything about a Fincher film, even the films that have funny parts and even, you know, we'll get to Fight Club, and there's a case to be made that Fight Club is almost a comedy, but Fight Club, you know, certainly doesn't feel like a comedy, you know?
Right.
All Fincher's films feel like you're watching a heavy, serious film.
Right.
And he's very good at that. And one of the things that's interesting in the game, which you could argue parallels what the Michael Douglas character is supposed to feel, is that the movie feels so heavy.
Yeah.
So, like, heavy and weighted down, that then to find out at the end that it was a game, it's kind of like there was too much heaviness to pull back. Like, you needed kind of a wackier, almost a Scorsese After Hours touch to that film, maybe.
Right.
Like, maybe that would have worked. About a slightly, you know, not to diminish the danger the character's in, but to have a more absurd take on it.
Well, the next film, I think, is sort of the quintessential movie of the 1990s, in my opinion, and that is The Fight Club. And, I just love The Fight Club. The Fight Club is a movie that holds up remarkably well, in my opinion. It has a lot to say about the times when it was made, but I think it still has a fair amount to say about our times as well. It's just kind of brilliantly conceived as a film. It's based on an excellent novel by Chuck Palahniuk, who, he's just sort of encapsulated the feeling of a lot of men in their early 20s, maybe early 30s at that particular time. And boy, I tell you, that movie really connected with me. And I know it connected with a lot of people.
Yeah, the movie when it came out was, the reception was kind of mixed.
Very mixed, very
but
mixed.
But then in, you know, not that long ago, I mean, the movie's from 1999. It's not, like, that old. Pretty quickly, people started to realize, you know, it's wrong to say a cult status, because there is a cult around that film, but
there
just
is.
Mainstream film critics who initially thought the movie was just kind of a brutal, they took it at face value, and then upon further viewing, they're like, you know, that movie's actually pretty great.
Right.
That movie to me is a dark comedy about masculinity. Like
Absolutely,
you say,
yeah.
It's about a search for men in the late 90s who they didn't know what they wanted. And, it, you know, there's elements at the time, there were these, what are the name of these gatherings where the men would like go out in the woods? And,
yes.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking. There was a movement of return to masculinity where men felt that they...
Like, even before the days of the term metrosexual, it was this fear of, like, you know, in our bones we're hunters and we don't need to do that anymore, and women want us to change diapers, and what happened to being a man? And it's this weird fear. And what's great about Fight Club is it pushes that thought, I mean, to this extreme.
Right.
Where the men, in order to feel masculine, have to just beat the shit out of each other.
Right, right.
I mean, so much so that the main character, you know, invents a whole separate personality to deal with his disconnection from his effeminized business self. And what's really great about that movie... And I read somewhere, I think maybe on the DVD, that Edward Norton also had this reaction that in some ways the movie reminds me of The Graduate, because both of those films are about people who are really frustrated with where they are in society at the moment. So they want to, like, burn down the existing society.
Right.
In Fight Club, literally burn it down.
Right, right.
But then... You know, at the end of both The Graduate and The Fight Club, you're left with main characters who are basically, the look on their faces, well, shit, what do we do now?
Yes.
Like, they don't, it's like, they're really, they want to burn down the existing society, but they don't have a plan to replace it.
Of course, of course.
And they want to create some new masculinity, but they don't know what that is.
Right. A Fight Club is there's a lot of levels of complexity to the Fight Club. It is interesting. It's like you mentioned the reception of the film, and the reception of the film was it wasn't just mixed. It was incredibly polarizing. There was a clear, like, the older film critics completely misunderstood the film.
Oh, they thought it was just pure, like, sadism.
Well, it was sadism. They accused it of fascism. I mean, obviously, you know, within the film, the main character, who doesn't have a name, basically Jack is what he's generally referred to, meets, quote-unquote, this gentleman named Tyler Durden, played by Brad Pitt. And him and Tyler Durden essentially start these bare-fisted boxing clubs, which... in fact, are somewhat real. They actually exist. But that's not enough for Tyler Durden. As the clubs gain more popularity, as they gain in membership, he sort of creates this, like, miniature army out of these clubs, and has this army commit acts of vandalism and crime and anarchism and all kinds of stuff. And within that strand of the story, a lot of critics were accusing Fincher and Polanyi and, you know, everybody involved with Fight Club of promoting some kind of fascist ideology, which, of course, the film in no way promotes and the novel in no way promotes. These guys were nihilists. Essentially, what Tyler Durden started was a cult of nihilism, people who did not believe in anything because there was nothing to believe in. And this is sort of this is really the main theme of Fight Club, is that man in the 90s, a young man had nothing to believe in. They had no real ideology, no cause, nothing to fight for, nothing to fight against. All they had was pure commercialism. And the entire thing was this sort of rebellion against commercialism, and that's what a lot of the older critics completely missed about the film. And, you know, it's interesting that that is exactly a lot of what the younger people completely understood about the film. The film very much tapped into the psyche, and it's very much it's one of those zeitgeist films. And this is a concept that that comes up in podcast after podcast about works of art that continually plugged into the collective subconscious of at least this country. And Fight Club is definitely there, big time. And, you know, for my money, it's the best film of the 90s. I can't think of another movie that came out in the 90s. And I'm going to include movies like Pulp Fiction, which is certainly great, and Sixth Sense and stuff like that. I mean, I'm sorry, Fight Club is number one, because Fight Club has a lot more to say about its time. It's a lot more socially relevant than Pulp Fiction. I mean, it may not be more original, but it may be, you know, in its own way, it's just as original because it is, it's crazy. It does have a twist ending. It does fool you. And also it doesn't cheat. It's actually honest about this, its conceit that this is a split personality, that Tyler Durden and Jack are the same guy. If you watch the film very carefully, there's very, very little. There's actually nothing that cheats the concept that this is the same guy. Nothing.
I mean, that's a movie with a major twist, but the major twist is not even, you know, the point of the film. It's like the major twist is just one manifestation of the themes that the film is about.
Exactly.
And I also want to give a special shout out to Helena Bonham Carter, who I don't know if that was her very first, you know, major non-corseted role. But, you know, Helena Bonham Carter made a gazillion either literal Merchant Ivory productions or Merchant Ivory-esque films in the 90s.
She was the queen of the costume.
Sure, and she wanted to get out of that. She was feeling a little pigeonholed. And, man, did she get out of it. Fight Club was, I feel, and successfully. I don't just mean her subsequent roles. I mean, she's great at Fight Club. Like, she's very believable. She's
but everybody, I mean, Meatloaf is friggin' great in Fight Club. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's true.
It's amazing. And you know, this is another interesting aspect that's worth mentioning about David Fincher, is how good he is with actors. I mean, the performances in his films are excellent. He uses Brad Pitt better than Brad Pitt's ever been used. I mean,
sure.
I think Brad Pitt...
They made three films together.
Absolutely, and they'll probably make more films together.
He's great in all of those movies.
Absolutely, absolutely. Brad Pitt is just owes the fact that he is a respected movie star, not just a movie star, a respected movie star as an actor, to David Fincher and films, particularly Seven and Fight Club, and later on Benjamin Button, of course. Fight Club is generally considered to be a fairly successful film. Everybody has seen Fight Club for the most part. Well, now Fincher, of course, had to follow up via Fight Club, which I'm sure he's extremely happy with because it was an artistic success. It's a film he wanted to make. He made it. It's exactly what he was looking to make. So how do you follow that up, Steve? I don't know. So
I don't know. I mean, reading between the lines, it seems like maybe he didn't know either. And so he made, 2 years later, Panic Room. Vote for the worst Fincher film.
Yeah,
I mean, agree. I'd put it below Alien 3 in the game.
Yeah,
and again, I will still say, not unwatchable, not a total turd.
Right.
Panic Room is the first film where I felt Fincher had a pretty weak movie.
Yeah.
And there's visual trickery in that film that felt like it was just done for the sake of visual trickery. You know,
right.
Like wacky camera moves up and down the house that seem to, you know, it's like they don't really, they're unmotivated, they don't do anything to help the story. It just screamed, hey, I know this is kind of boring. How about I have a crazy tracking shot just to jazz this shit up a little bit?
There's very little I like about Panic Room, Steve. Very little. I just don't like that movie at all.
Yeah,
it doesn't do it for me.
Panic Room appealed to people who went to see all those Ashley Judd thrillers. You know, it just fit right in with, like, you know, Fincher himself called it, he's like, it's a decent date movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Woman in Jeopardy, fighting against the odds.
Exactly.
You know, defeating the evil, nasty men and... I almost feel like we're talking about it too much, Steve, because
we should move on.
The less said about this movie, the better. So exactly.
Well, I have not read, and I obviously don't know David Fincher personally, but it seems like he retrenched a little after that.
Yeah.
There's a 5-year gap. He took a break. Maybe he wanted to really be motivated about his next project.
Yeah, he needed to take stock. Take stock.
I hope that's what he did. Whatever he did, I'm going to say it worked, because Fincher's made 3 films since that break. All of those films, I think, are excellent. And he's now moving into this really exciting kind of middle period of his career. And he also went digital, should be noted.
Yes.
That Panic Room is the last film he shot on film. And beginning with Zodiac, his next movie, everything is digital.
Absolutely. And honestly, for my money, there's virtually nobody in Hollywood that uses digital cinematography as well as David Fincher. David Fincher is really just a master of digital cinematography. His stuff looks great. It doesn't draw attention to its digitalness. It doesn't look quite like film, but it looks pretty damn close. And it's always used very well to serve the story. And it works very well for him. And Zodiac, well, I'm a big fan of Zodiac.
I am Zodiac too. I think it's great. It's the rare, long, slightly slow film.
Yes.
That felt like it could go on another 2 hours. Yeah. It does an excellent job of drawing you into the obsessions of the main character, and where, you know, you feel like you are kind of researching this puzzle.
The movie just very, very, very meticulously tracks the process of both the murders and the tracking of the murder, because it was sort of parallel things happening there. There was, while the guy was committing his murders, the newspaper was tracking him, because San Francisco Chronicle is the newspaper he was communicating with, while the police were trying to catch him on a parallel track. And in the meantime, while this was happening, Hollywood produced a little film called Dirty Harry, which was essentially a wish fulfillment cop drama about catching and killing the Zodiac Killer. That's, of course, everybody's seen Dirty Harry. It stars Clint Eastwood. It's a classic of the police genre. But it's this sort of a weird thing that's tied into the whole thing. So literally, while the Zodiac Killer was still killing people in San Francisco, Hollywood put out a movie called Dirty Harry, where Clint Eastwood catches and beats the crap out of the Zodiac Killer. Unfortunately, that never really happened.
You know, the main character in the movie,
it's played by Jake Gyllenhaal, right?
You know, he is, Zodiac, if nothing else, made Jake Gyllenhaal tolerable for 3 hours, which I consider a major achievement.
That is a major achievement. Yes.
But, you know, that is a real person. But in the movie, he's also very much an audience surrogate.
Right.
Where he's like, I'm just a normal guy. But he became obsessed with the idea. It's beyond just catching the killer. It's like, surely there's got to be a way. Like, that character is like, there's got to be something, somebody's missing. You know, and he starts out just reporting on the story, but then he gets in deeper and deeper, and it just becomes this obsession of his of, there's got to, you know, there has to be an answer. Like, someone is doing these killings, and it seems absurd to that character that we can't figure it out. And it consumes his life. I mean, it costs mm-hmm. him a marriage.
Right.
Maybe two, I forget. And yeah, it's a fascinating movie. It's very interesting. It's also, you know, it's not overly slow, but it, you know, it takes its time. It's certainly not geared towards 14-year-olds.
It's deliberate. You need to kind of sink into the film, and if you cannot really devote your full attention to it, I would suggest putting it aside for another time. But if you do have a few hours to kill and you want to watch an excellent film and you haven't seen it before, I'd really recommend Zodiac. Also, we have to mention that there's essentially three leads in Zodiac. There's Jake Gyllenhaal is really the main character, but the other two main characters are played by Robert Downey Jr., and Mark Ruffalo plays the police side of the triangle. Now, Ruffalo, I have some issues with his performance, to be honest with you. To me, he's actually surprisingly the weak link out of those three. But Downey is fantastic in
the film.
And this was, I have to say, the real rebirth of Robert Downey as a viable actor, because he was so magnetic in the film and so interesting and so very much like, even though he played a real character, he was very much Robert Downey in his element of being Robert Downey.
Sure.
It's very much, you know, Robert Downey's a movie star. Yes, he's an actor, but he's a movie star in a sense that he kind of plays variations.
He's got a shtick.
Yes, he
did.
But in a good way.
I say that as a fan.
Yes.
I mean, it. And as with all movie stars with shtick, it's like it can be applied well or less well.
Right, right. Well, in that movie, we saw glimpses of what Robert Downey can do. He's really, really good, and the film is excellent, and really highly recommended. And not a huge hit for anybody involved, but I think artistically, kind of a triumph for Fincher.
Well, his next film, which came out just 1 year later, and another long, ambitious, seemingly complicated, logistically film, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Also like Zodiac, although they're very different films, this is a slowly paced, long film for adults that was somewhat polarizing. That yeah. There are some people I know who just think that is Benjamin Button is a boring, pretentious. I really enjoyed Benjamin Button. Yeah. I read a review once that just described it simply as a fairy tale for adults, and you know, about mortality and aging, and I thought that's what it was. I thought the film was very moving.
Yeah.
It also really showcased one of the things that's great about Fincher, similar to Peter Jackson, although they're very different filmmakers, and not only has he got a strong hold in making digital movies so that you don't see the seams, Fincher is just a master of effects, and the best kind of special effects master, in that they're just seamlessly integrated into the movie, and you just roll with it. I mean, you just buy the effect, and there's not a lot of attention drawn to it, and you just go on. And Benjamin Button obviously has crazy aging processes and transplanting Brad Pitt's head on various bodies. And to me, the whole thing worked. I found the movie very moving, and I bought the central love story between him and the Cate Blanchett character. And there's a lot of interesting supporting characters. I don't know. What's your take on Benjamin Button?
I really like it. I think it's certainly... it's the most emotional film that David Fincher's ever made. I would say Benjamin Button, while I liked it, while I definitely thought it was one of the best films of that year and deserved to be in the top echelon of films and was nominated for Best Picture and so on and so forth, it wasn't a perfect film. I think the main flaw of Benjamin Button was that Fincher just tried to stuff a little too much.
Yeah,
you know,
there's
a little, few too many curly cues in
there. Yeah, there's a Forrest Gump aspect to it of trying to shoehorn that character into
historical
a lot
stuff.
Of events.
Well, that's a common criticism, is that it's sort of Forrest Gumpy. I don't think it's that Forrest Gumpy, but yeah. My issues with it.
I think it's a little Forrest.
Well,
Gump.
It's got it is. It's hard to deny that it is. Well, you know, it's got the bookends, right? It's got a story that it's bookended with this present day or Hurricane Katrina era. The movie is set primarily in New Orleans, you know, it's got these bookends of during the Hurricane Katrina, where one of the film's main characters is on her deathbed and she's telling the story of Benjamin Button to her daughter, you know, it's just, I don't like that bookends thing. I never like I never like the conceit in movies where characters
particularly effective bookend.
Get old and die. Yeah. I don't like that. I think that's a cheap way, fairly cheap way of getting sympathy. I think, I don't know, it's too much. Then there's a whole thing with a clock, which I actually like more than the bookends. I wouldn't mind if they kept the clock, but throughout the bookends, you know, the stuff with the old woman in the hospital, that would have been preferable to me, I think. I don't know. I mean, that's really its main flaw. It's just tries to do a little too much. I think it would have worked better if it was a little more straightforward. And it's interesting. It's interesting that criticism plays very well into Fincher's next film, The Social Network, which is incredibly straightforward.
As somebody who didn't really have a problem with the length of Zodiac and Benjamin Button, The Social Network feels a little bit like Fincher, you know, he trimmed the fat. I mean, it's a fast-moving two-hour movie. But
exactly.
He didn't lose the intelligence. I mean, the beginning of The Social Network, it's like, strap in.
Exactly. The movie instantly lets you know where it is. It starts with a very long scene in a bar. It's a conversation between a college guy, Mark Zuckerberg, who eventually went on to create Facebook, the phenomenon that is Facebook.
Yes.
And it's just him talking to his girlfriend in his bar. And essentially it's the disintegration of their relationship that happens over the course of this 10-minute scene. Again, Fincher's not a writer, so the Social Network was written by Aaron Sorkin. Some say the great Aaron Sorkin. I don't think he's that great, but he certainly wrote a hell of a screenplay.
I'd be stunned if that's not nominated.
I'll be stunned if it doesn't win. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But it's more than just a screenplay. Obviously, the screenplay kind of is a building block of The Social Network. I think the real star of The Social Network is Fincher. His direction is so precise. He just nails every single scene perfectly, and outside of the individual scene, the whole film works. You know how a lot of times you see movies where it's just a hodgepodge of excellent scenes, but the film really doesn't hold
together. Yes, there's very much a coherent vision for how the 2 hours should play, exactly. Not just the 5-minute blocks.
Yeah.
And in its own way, The Social Network is just as logistically complicated as Zodiac or Benjamin Button. It takes place over a smaller period of time, but there's multiple. It jumps around in time a lot,
right?
In a way that doesn't feel disorienting. And the early scenes of when Zuckerberg creates this face smash, is that it? You have to judge between the two women.
Right.
How that kind of spreads across the campus. That scene's handled perfectly. It's got the right number of shots and different locations to really give you the vibe of Harvard and how that's just spreading around and jumping to the court scenes. And it's great. I will say Jesse Eisenberg, too, who I enjoy. He can be a little one-note. Is great in the film. He just adds this great sneer to his arsenal, which is very effective.
Yeah, he's absolutely excellent, and I've enjoyed him in other films. And Jesse Eisenberg is one of those guys. He's been acting since he was like 12 years old. He's been around for a long time. We've all seen him in lots of movies, and in the past few years, he's kind of fallen into that teenage dork category. I made a joke once about him. He should make a movie with Michael Cera where they would play like twins separated at birth.
Yeah.
And then they would switch places even though they don't actually look alike. They act alike so much that nobody notices.
And they have the same roles. You have to imagine that, I guess maybe Michael Cera would be the first call, but you can imagine people casting a quirky indie and they're like, there's the Michael Cera character, and you call him and he's busy and they're like, well, let's call Jesse Eisenberg.
I guess you got to call Eisenberg. Okay, but it's funny actually. And along the same lines, I can actually see Michael Cera playing Zuckerberg in the Social Network too. I think he'd be fine as well.
Eisenberg at least vocally is better.
I agree with you, and I think Eisenberg is more actually kind of threatening.
Exactly. There's an edge to him.
Yeah, there's an intensity to him that Sarah does not quite have yet. And this movie, I think, is going to open up a lot of doors. Eisenberg was so fantastic.
Yeah, and I want to talk a bit about the Zuckerberg character as opposed to the Zuckerberg man. There's been some, I wouldn't call it a backlash, that's the wrong word, but there's been some talk with The Social Network, as with any movie based on real people, mm-hmm. about like, well, how factual is it?
Right.
And Zuckerberg is not thrilled at the existence of the movie. I saw a little brief interview with him where he was out of college and somebody asked him, at first he said he wasn't going to see it, and then he answered a question that made it clear he's seen it. And it was probably recommended by his lawyers, you're going to get questions about this shit, you should see it.
I'd want to see it. Somebody made a movie about me, and
if anybody made a movie about you, you're going to disagree. And the main, apparently where they've taken liberties isn't in the facts of the movie, but in some of the motivations. Zuckerberg claims that, that girlfriend at the beginning, that character didn't exist. That the motivations of the Zuckerberg character in the movie are a little bit, from one angle, which I don't think is totally correct, but it's also not meritless. The whole Facebook empire was based on a broken heart. there's a bookending shot in The Social Network that Zuckerberg is still at least somewhat pining for this girl who dumps him in the initial scene, and that girl didn't exist. Zuckerberg claims he didn't really want to get into these elite clubs. I'm a big believer in, and so is Fincher from what I've read, that they're, Fincher's, in his mind, he's like, I don't want to get sued, but what my job is to make a great movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate, I guess, for the real Zuckerberg that he has to go through life with people assuming that, you know, this is 100% what happened.
Right.
And, you know, you could go the Citizen Kane route and, you know, and call your movie,
right,
you know, My Face, and create a character named, like, you know, Marvin Zuckerberg. And, you know, like, where everybody knows what you're talking about.
Right.
But without, so that way you could take more liberties. You know, Fincher and Sorkin are like, fuck it, we're creating our version of it. I mean, Fincher calls the movie, he says it's a fiction.
Yeah.
You know, like, Sorkin says it's nonfiction, but he's like, look, I made this character. And the character Zuckerberg is fascinating because he's not purely a dick.
No.
I mean, he comes across as a guy who's really smart, he's really socially awkward, he's really uncomfortable at his social status.
Yes.
And he constantly feels the need, like, he's not confident enough just knowing he's the smartest guy in the room. And 9 times out of 10, he is the smartest guy in the room. But he has to make sure everyone is constantly reminded of that.
Yeah.
So he makes these comments to people about, you know, just a, let me make it clear, I am the smartest guy in this room.
Right.
Which, you know, comes across as arrogant and dickish and alienates a lot of friends and lovers inside the movie.
That character is all about status in that film. Again, I have absolutely no idea what the real Zuckerberg is like. But I think the point of The Social Network is sort of this search for status. It's a search for self-validation.
And it's a social, it's not a economic.
No, exactly. It has nothing to do with money. It's almost the exact opposite. Money is incidental. There's a big aspect of Social Network where characters talk about it all the time, especially in Zuckerberg's case. He doesn't give a shit about money. Money is not that important to him. It's almost a byproduct. I mean, he's not against money. He's not against making money. But it's not the most important thing to him. And one of the most important decisions he makes throughout the course of the film is that he doesn't want to commercialize his product. He wants it to be a little bit of an underground. He wants it to have street cred. And that, in fact, launches Facebook into the next strata of success. People like the fact that it's not overly commercialized, and to this day, it's still, like, reasonably commercialized. The advertising that happens within Facebook itself is kind of organically integrated into Facebook, and that's part of what he wants. He's interested in this, like, social status of the underground. But to go back to what I was saying before, this concept of the social status, about self-validation, is sort of another key concept in this day and age. And here again is David Fincher working with somebody else's material, with material somebody else wrote, and creating this zeitgeist moment where a film he makes, again like Fight Club, taps into what everybody seems to be thinking, but they're not even aware that they're thinking it. So that's what makes it a great film. Not only is it entertaining, well-written, well-acted, very well-directed, but it goes a step beyond, and it kind of tells us something about ourselves and our obsession with this alternative life on the internet, this sort of virtual existence that a lot of us lead on Facebook that's complete nonsense. Let's see, if electricity went out, that whole thing is gone in the toilet. You know, there is no Facebook. Everything we post on Facebook is just nothing. It's just zeros and ones. It's non-existent. And of course, you have to take stock of what it is that's really important and what, you know, what's real and what's not real. And so it's an interesting thing that, you know, in the process of creating this social network that everybody joins and gets a million friends, and it becomes a race for friends, and you're talking to your friends and all these virtual friends, is this guy who seems to be incapable of actually having real friends.
Yeah.
To get away from that a little bit, the acting in the film across the board is excellent, right?
Yes, it is. Everybody's, I don't even know.
Well, young actors, I mean, everybody knows Justin Timberlake, and think of him what you will. He's great in the film.
He's great.
I love him in the movie. The British kid, who's the new Spider-Man, who plays Eduardo Severin, his best friend, and the guy he kind of screws over.
He
the
is
most.
Excellent. He's a really skinny guy with kind of a big head and big hair that emphasizes his big head.
Right, right.
So I had a little bit of a visual thing with him. His performance was excellent.
Yeah.
Like, that was minor. The one actor who plays the twins.
Oh,
is
yeah.
Great.
Armie Hammer is fantastic. Yeah, the whole twins thing, that's another aspect where Fincher's mastery of special effects really, really comes into play.
You don't even notice it, yeah.
It's unnoticeable. I just talked to a good friend of mine who like had no idea that this was not twins playing twins. The thought that this was the same actor playing both of these guys didn't even occur to him. And this is a fairly savvy guy who's seen a lot of movies. Had no idea. And it's great. I think that's exactly what special effects should be like.
The twins are really interesting to me, too, because they come from very much a position of wealth and privilege. Like, that is the background of these characters. But if you watch the movie, you know, they're not assholes. You know, they're not played. You know, you get hints that obviously, you know, these guys have had a lot of doors open to them. And there's even a time where the president of Harvard gives them a speech about, you know, oh, you only get a meeting with me because your dad's important.
Mm-hmm.
But the twins themselves, like, you know, they're not just spoiled dicks. Like, they're guys in college who had an idea who sincerely think they were wronged. They honestly think they had this idea that Zuckerberg stole, and Zuckerberg dicked them around. And for a long time in the film, you know, one of the twins does not want to go after him in court just because he thinks that's, you know, it's kind of low rent. You know, that's just, it's not honorable. There's a great, one of my favorite lines in the film is they're like, well, why don't we go after him? And one of the twins says, because we'll look like guys in skeleton costumes chasing the Karate Kid. And that's, I mean, like, they're aware that, you know, the way it'll look to outsiders is Zuckerberg is this, you know, and he's not a poor kid. Let's not, but, you know, Zuckerberg is a middle-class kid.
Right.
Who's kind of nerdy.
Compared to these blue
and
bloods.
It'll look horrible if these hulking, like,
right, right.
crew-rowing guys
yeah.
just start harassing this computer nerd.
Absolutely. Well, those guys come off well. The Winklevoss twins.
The Winklevi.
The Winklevi, as he cleverly calls them. You know, they're still suing Zuckerberg. I mean, the lawsuit is pending right now.
They want everything. They love the film, by the way.
Oh, I'm sure they do. Well, they're not portrayed in a bad light. Listen, I bet you deep in his own heart, Zuckerberg loves the film because the film does not portray him as a bad guy. The film is sensitive to his needs and his concerns. But, you know, the movie is fair. It presents the situation fairly. It presents his point of view. It doesn't show him as a heartless villain. It shows him as a, you know, as a kid who's very bright and very intelligent and who just doesn't quite get it, you know? Doesn't seem
yeah.
to understand.
I mean, he seems like a little bit, he seems like an asshole, but not an unsympathetic asshole.
Yeah,
like,
very
he seems
much.
Like a guy that you're like, you know, if somebody could make him see some things, maybe change. And the real Zuckerberg acts like, you know, in some ways he hasn't denied parts of how he acted in the film. He's been more like, well, look, a lot of people were maybe selfish and kind of dicky when they were 20. And give me a break.
Yeah.
From the old age of, I think he's 26 now.
The sweetest character is the Eduardo Severin, and Andrew Garfield is, of course, the name of the actor who plays him. And he comes off almost as a little too angelic. But
and
at the
he,
same
I
time...
I mean, he had the most, from what I've read, the most connection with...
Well, he does. Yeah, you know,
I mean, it's based on a book.
It's based on a book.
That the author of the book, you know, interviewed a bunch of people, and one of the main people he had extensive interviews with was
Eduardo Severin. Absolutely. And you know, in defense of Zuckerberg settled with Severin. Supposedly, they are friendly again. And if you look at the bottom of your Facebook page, Severin's name is there. So he's been sort of reinstated as a co-creator of Facebook. So you got to give it to Zuckerberg. He has, at least in the case of this guy who was, of course, a co-creator of this thing and was, in fact, his best friend, he kind of...
Well,
He did somewhat right.
Without knowing the settlement...
The numerical amount. Listen,
well, what I mean, too, is that, you know, the whole masthead thing, that could be... If you're ordered by a court of law to do something, I don't know if that counts.
No, it was a settlement. He was not ordered by the court of law. It was a settlement. He settled with him individually. Remember, the he settled with the Winklevi as well. The
Winklevi got almost 70 million. Because they're debating about whether or not he gave them a fair percentage.
Well, $70 million is what the Winklevi got. Not a bad sum. And
I'd
you
walk
could
away.
Only imagine. Well, if you had a twin, though, that's really only 35. Or less, you know, think about it. It's two
after
of them.
Taxes. There's, I mean, you're down
after
around
taxes,
20.
Now, and, you know, these are rich kids. You know, it's not that much for them. But for Severin, I'm sure the settlement was much more generous. Again, he's certainly presented as the most sympathetic character in the film, And for my money, that's probably Andrew Garfield's probably my favorite performance in a film, full of great performances.
I'm kind of, you know, what I've not heard any reaction to from the real-life counterpart is, you want to talk about who comes off looking like a major douchebag in the film, it's that Napster Sean kid played by Justin Timberlake. He comes off as a kid who had one interesting idea when he was 17, and now he's a coke-filled partying idiot.
Yeah.
I mean,
he doesn't
come off as a very sympathetic character.
It's not, he's lovable in his own silly way.
I guess,
I like that guy. I mean, out of that whole group, I'd probably rather hang out with him than I would with I agree with you. He does, but hey, you know, he doesn't have the money anymore, so no, he can't really afford to sue.
That's one of the things the movie didn't fully explain to me, and I always wonder about this stuff, and it could just be due to my non-business education. But you know, like, I just didn't understand logistically how that dude's life worked. Like, just did he live on credit? You know, like, he doesn't have any place to live, but he can go to these clubs and just drink till his heart's content.
Well, you know, he's got money. He does have money. It's just he's got human money. You know, he doesn't have Zuckerberg money where you could buy a country. He does his job as a character in that film very well.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And JT does an excellent job playing him, so that works out well. But well, what can you say? I mean, Social Network, you know, if a better movie comes out between now and Oscar time, I would be very surprised. And if another movie comes out that ends up winning the Oscar over The Social Network, I will also be very surprised. This movie is not only excellent as a standalone work of art, as I said, it is also a movie that sort of taps into the zeitgeist of the country, and just for that, it deserves an Oscar. So I'm predicting Best Picture win for Fincher, and a well-deserved one for The Social Network.
We got to see what else comes out, but yeah. So I mean, these are very different films, but to go back to another notable 2010 release that we discussed on Spoiler Alert, if you had to rank, would you rank The Social Network above Inception?
I would. Yeah, it's a better film than Inception. Yeah, it doesn't have as many holes as Inception does. And I mean, it's more, again, Inception is a very entertaining ride. It's ingenious.
Oh, yeah.
I
was just kind of throwing that out there. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, one of the things I love about art as opposed to, you know, say sports or something, like they're, you know, there doesn't have to be one champion.
It's also quite successful. I mean, it wasn't a very expensive
film.
No.
Yeah, it's making money.
It was a huge hit. I mean, it was a number one movie for a couple of weeks in a row, which is mind-boggling for a talky sort of courtroom procedural type of a movie starring a bunch of non-stars, really.
Yeah.
Certainly non-movie stars. I mean, that's amazing. And so, yeah, the movie was just a home run on virtually every single thing that it set out to do. Fincher just hit it out of the park, and it's, along with Fight Club, it's his best film, and that's saying something. There's certainly a lot more we could say about Fincher, but let me just ask you a question. Is there like a David Fincher theme?
Well, there's one I read, and I'm going to give credit where credit's due. I read this in a Fincher kind of an article, not necessarily a profile, in The New Yorker from David Denby, and he pointed out the recurring fascination with outsiders in Fincher's role. Like, outsiders and how they interact with the larger society. Going back, you know, Seven, there's the fascination of the serial killer, mm-hmm. who obviously is, you know, has issues with society, Fight Club, we've discussed. Right. The Game, you could say. The Game is about somebody who's not fitting into society and the attempts of his family to try and bring him back in, you mm-hmm. know, to make him appreciate better. You know, Zodiac, once again, we have The Killer. Panic Room, you know, Panic Room's a genre exercise, but even within that, you know, there's the Forrest Whitaker character who feels like he's committing crime just for somewhat noble purposes. Benjamin Button, obviously, is about a character who doesn't right. really fit in. And The Social Network is about a social outsider.
Yeah, misfit.
And that's, not only is the creation of Facebook out to prove, you know, what he can do and to attract people, but the themes of The Social Network are about a character who feels excluded, so he creates a whole world that is, you know, it's exclusive, but it just spreads to the point where it includes everybody. That, you know,
yes.
and, yeah, like trying right. to almost obliterate privacy.
Right.
And so, you know, I feel there's a lot of, maybe that's a recurring fascination, and it's not just one angle on an outsider. Like
right.
some of the movies are the outsider is the protagonist. Some of the movies, like Seven and Zodiac, it's the outsider is the subject. It's the movie is about people attempting to understand the outsider.
At the same time, I have to say that to me, Fincher is one of those. One of those journeyman directors. He's just incredibly versatile. He seems to be able to work in different styles. He is, again, he's not a writer-director. He's a director for hire, like kind of an old-school Hollywood director. And in that regard, he's amongst the best. He's certainly the best in his generation, just on a purely technical level. And I'm excited to see what he does next. I mean, what's on the slate for Fincher?
The question is, what isn't on the slate for Fincher? I mean, he's one of those guys who the announced projects for Fincher mm-hmm. Probably exceed the total number of films he's made to date. I know for a fact his very next film is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, mm-hmm. based on the popular novels.
Right.
There's already, of course, Swedish movies based on these novels, but Fincher's doing the American one. And the actress, I want to say her name's Rooney? The actress who plays Zuckerberg's girlfriend in the initial
yes,
scene
yes.
is the lead in that.
Yes, so. Mara Rooney, and
yeah.
she's very good.
But yeah, so he's doing The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. There's been a lot of talk about him doing a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea remake.
That's interesting.
Which it's interesting, but also sounds almost less interesting in terms of what we've been talking about for the picture. It's hard to imagine. That, I'm sure, will look good. I guess it's curious to see if you can turn that into anything other than a big-budget thrill ride.
Yeah, he has a lot on his plate, it seems like. And you know, again, he sort of developed this ability to work very quickly for a guy who is also known for being extremely meticulous on the set, kind of tyrannical. He's supposed to be a very nice guy, but he definitely works on getting his way on the set. He does a lot of takes with actors. A lot of actors don't like that. A lot of actors really don't like that. But actors that are willing to play with him usually end up with some pretty excellent performances on
yeah,
the
I mean, it's hard to fault the performances in Fincher's movies.
No, they're across the board excellent.
At this point, you have to imagine a lot of actors, you know, if they're hating the process, have to remind themselves, like, well, I've seen those other movies, and everybody looks great in them, so maybe I should
shut up and roll.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. I mean, as a director, it's hard for me personally to imagine doing 50 takes of anything unless somebody is really screwing up.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it takes all kinds. I mean, Clint Eastwood gets some awesome performances, and he supposedly rarely goes to 3 takes.
Yes, yes. That's pretty amazing to me to do 50 takes. 50 takes of any, just one chunk of dialogue takes hours.
Yeah.
So if you got a few pages of dialogue, you're doing 50 takes of every line. Holy crap!
Yeah,
that takes a long time.
I mean, and yeah. The Social Network. There's a lot of talking in that movie,
right.
and it's very fast paced. So I mean, on the page, that's probably like a 200 page script. I mean, that's
right.
But, yeah, I mean, for all that said, for his meticulousness and his multiple takes, he's churning them out since he converted digital. It's
exactly.
Zodiac was 2007, Benjamin Button was 2008, Social Network 2010. I'm pretty sure the girl with the dragon tattoo will be out in 2011.
Yeah, he's like, got a movie a year. He's like, he's on a tear. He's got a Woody Allen, but unlike those guys, he's not really coasting. I mean, he's really taking chances, and it's exciting to see what he's going to do next. So
he's in the zone. I love it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So more power to Fincher, and you know, we're obviously big fans of his. And if you haven't seen all of his films, he doesn't have that many. So you should really check him out, even the secondary works, you know, like Alien 3 and The Game. Definitely worth seeing. Definitely,
you can skip
definitely
Panic
worth.
Room.
Yeah, you can skip Panic Room, but you know what? Even that's watchable. So it's the man has never made a truly crappy movie.
No, he hasn't.
He just made a movie that was kind of weak, and that is The Panic Room. But everything else has been pretty outstanding, and he seems to be getting better as a director. So
he does.
That's always heartening. So. Well, we have arrived at our destination, Steve. We are here, and thanks for joining us.
All right. I'm Steve Asgen.
I'm Andre Shane.
We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Stop.